This episode is brought to you by Independent Perspective, a strategic and creative UK-based consultancy. For a fresh perspective on your business, head over to independentperspective.co.
So this week, or for this episode, we're going to be talking about international development aid, but from a slightly different perspective, as you'd expect. And we want to talk about really how we in this country can learn from those countries that receive development aid from us, for example, Africa, because I think there's a lot
as
of...
As a group of countries.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah, that's a good point. Because there are a lot of misconceptions about it, it seems to me. So I thought I'd start by giving a little bit of background. But we've got someone to help us with all this, Catherine Fitzgibbon, who has worked in... I got it right, Catherine.
Brilliant.
First time in weeks. And Catherine's been involved in international development for many years, both in the field as a country director, but also as a consultant to international agencies and so on, and she'll perhaps talk about that a little bit in a bit more detail later. But the other interesting thing about Catherine, which is why I really thought it'd be a helpful conversation, is she's had a similar role actually operating in this country, which most people wouldn't think of in terms of being a recipient country for development advice and assistance and consultancy, but it puts a very different flavour on it. And I got involved in international development aid by accident when I was asked to put together a sort of strategic review for a large international development agency in Dublin. And that was my very first experience of it. And then I got more involved by joining the board and so on, and ended up doing a little bit of work in Africa. And I discovered very quickly that the perception that I had of development work and international aid and so on had been informed by a narrative created by tabloid newspapers and politicians and so on, that was completely at odds with what I was experiencing in the real world. And I'm quite excited to have this opportunity to have this conversation, because I'd always felt that there needed to be an alternative voice. People needed to be understanding a bit better what's going on from a slightly different perspective. So that's the starting point. So not least, we have this situation currently where, with austerity and so on, there's a big debate going on about whether we should be spending anything on international development aid. I think we currently spend something like $14 billion a year. And it's become a very politicised conversation where people are saying, well, if we haven't got schools that are running properly and the NHS needs money and we need money for this, that, other and which, surely we shouldn't be spending money on other people. We should be looking after our own first. So I'm really looking forward to having that sort of broad conversation. And as I say, Catherine is here to help us. So Catherine, welcome. And would you perhaps just briefly give us a sense of A, what you do and how you got into it in the first place?
Right. Hello. Hi. Nice to be here. Yeah, so Like you said, I actually started life in this country, well, actually working with a local authority in London as a policy planner, looking at planning issues. And then I moved to a housing association, so looking at, you know, social housing and developing housing. And then I worked as an economic development consultant. So in a way, I was working in development here because at that time there was a lot of grants from the EU, believe it or not, to places like, you know, the northeast of England, Sunderland, South Wales, you know, the former industrial areas, places like Cornwall. They were seen as having a GDP way below the EU average, and therefore they were getting a lot of assistance. There was also a lot of government grants. There was things called City Challenge, single regeneration budgets. So it was actually sort of development aid for marginal areas of the UK. I mean, indeed, there probably still is, but probably much less, because obviously when the EU extended, those parts of England weren't comparatively as poor as some of those other parts of Europe. So they lost out. But that was all after I finished working in it. But I had always been really keen to work overseas. And at that time, initially agencies say, oh, well, you've got no overseas experience, so, you know, it's not really relevant, et cetera, et cetera. And then finally, I actually ended up doing, as I think a lot of people get into aid, is emergency relief. And I ended up working in Central America, actually, following hurricane, doing self-help housing. And that was ironic because, you know, that agency said, oh, you've worked for a housing association, you can come and do the housing, post-hurricane housing. And it was a completely different circumstance. I mean, you know, it was interesting what people thought was a transferable skill. Was not, but what was a transferable skill were things like just the fact that having worked in a professional environment, being able to have systems. You know, I walked into, it was an Irish NGO Goal that I would initially work for, and they had just started from scratch and there was pure chaos. And so it was the things that I was bringing to that job were completely different to understanding, you know, housing development, because it's of course a completely different situation there. Anyway, from then on, I did a lot of development work, and actually I spent 15 years in Africa, mostly in Ethiopia and Kenya, working with Save the Children. I was their operations director in Ethiopia, their country director in Kenya, and various other roles. Also done a lot of work in Somalia, quite a bit in Uganda, and various parts of East Africa. And I stopped working for NGOs about 8 years ago, and since then I've been working for a range of agencies, including the UN, donors like DFID, the Department for International Development, and currently doing quite a lot of work with the World Bank. So I've come at development from a whole range of perspectives, from self-help grassroots NGOs to big international donors. But for the last 4 years, I've moved back to the UK, which I hadn't lived in for a long time. And it was just as Brexit happened and, you know, all these sort of, there's quite a lot of chaos going on in the UK. So it has made me very much think about development issues in the UK from that perspective, as well as obviously, you know, I'm still working mostly on development issues in Africa.
What an interesting time to have a conversation about this with you.
Yes. So in terms of, you know, the aid debate, I think I was always very, you know, sort of proud when I was overseas, and I was living in Nairobi for a long time, that the UK continued to keep to the 0.7% pledge for overseas aid, despite, you know, austerity and whatever. But then it was only coming back to this country did I realise how quite tenuous that commitment has been, and how much pressure there is upon the government in the face of public opinion.
So could you just explain? So it's 0.7% of our gross domestic product.
Yes. So that does lead to variable amounts. And like you say, the more our economy grows, the more aid we give. And that was kind of agreed as the international minimum standard. And there's not many countries that actually keep to that standard at all. It's kind of us and a few of the Norwegians. There was for a little bit of time Ireland tried to. And I think they're trying to go back to that again. So,
which is pretty impressive, really. We're one of the few countries anywhere that is keeping to that commitment.
Yes, it is, really. It is, but it depends which way you're looking at it. For a lot of people, I think, well, it's totally unimpressive because that money should be being spent in the UK.
Did you find that the attitude has changed from when you left Britain and when you came back, the attitude towards making these sort of donations or
contributions?
It depends. So I think I felt that it had changed, and I used to think it was because I don't know if about you are, but me and Jeremy, we're the live aid generation. So we grew up, you know, we were sort of formative years, feeling like, wow, we have to give aid to Africa, look at all those Ethiopians starving, da da da. So there was this very much a generational shift that it was felt a really important thing to do. And I felt, you know, leaders like, you know, Cameron and Blair were also the live aid generation, and therefore they maintained that whole way of thinking about it. I suppose what's made me realise about it is the whole shift with the Brexit thing, because Brexit has created this chasm in our society between the outward looking globalists that are sort of feeling, yes, we should be looking at a you know, multilateral approach to development and world problems, to the more nationalist, populist agenda, which is, you know, let's look at where we are first, look after people here first, and that sort of thing. So it definitely fits into that split very neatly. That would, I think, would be one of the defining, you know, your views on that would possibly follow very clearly along that divide. And of course, since Brexit, that, you know, there is a strong and, you know, indeed, you know, half the country that are sort of sharing those sort of views. And I would have thought that they would have diminished much smaller. I think when I was overseas, I was believing to think, oh, it was an older thing. You know, those people are just tying off. But now I think there has been a rise of that. And it was also probably fed by austerity. When you feel like you're having to make sacrifices at home, you're feeling less generous. You're feeling like there's less money to go around. So why are we still giving them the same amount? So I understand it to some extent. But then on the other side is people don't understand what the two ways of looking at it. People don't understand often what that money is being spent on. And maybe they don't understand the benefits of everyone developing. And also the fact that, you know, in some respects, a lot of people have never travelled. And when you've seen really absolute poverty of the sort we do not have in this country on a really, you know, widespread basis, you know, I think that would change a lot of people's minds. But, you know, there is a benefit, you know, it's not just a zero sum game. You know, I think that the way we can look at overseas aid is it's investment. I mean, it genuinely is investment. You can invest in the social welfare of a country and benefit everyone.
One of the previous episodes we've had was on fake news. And I went to a very, very interesting lecture around the international, you know, about the money that we're supposed to be spending on international development aid. And actually, there is a very strong argument that says we're still taking out much more money from Africa than we're putting in, something in the order of £43 billion a year in the form of interest on loans that have been made, in profits that are taken out of Africa and transferred, sometimes illegally or through all sorts of tax measures, out of Africa into the developed West. So it's not nearly as black and white as it's presented. And and there are many people, I mean, there are people like Jason Tickle, who's a professor at the LSE, who's done a lot of work on this. And when you start thinking of it in those terms, it puts a completely different complexion on it. Because I was brought up to think that, you know, Africans need help, we're helping them.
They're starving.
Yeah, therefore we're giving them loads of money. Mm. And actually, if you speak to other people, they'll say, actually, all that's happening is it's a continuation of the West, the developed West, extracting money from these countries, you know, and it gives you a completely different complexion of it.
I've actually developed more and more of an awareness of colonial bias, as I generally call it, and coming from New Zealand through Australia to England, and having spent a bit of time in Canada and America, I can see how people in England don't realize what an empire actually is in terms of the flow of goods. And people don't seem to realize that food being so cheap in supermarkets in England means that food is more expensive elsewhere.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And I can imagine that people are worried about their camembert, but other places don't have cheese.
I've got a great quote here from a lady called Aisha Dodwell, who works for Global Justice. And she was quoted as saying, "There's such a powerful narrative in Western societies that Africa is poor, that it needs our help. This research shows that what African countries really need is for the rest of the world to stop systematically looting them," which is really quite interesting.
What's your perspective on that, Catherine, having been on the ground in a number of countries?
I think that's completely true. I mean, so if you look at the US, the USA budget dwarfs the UK, right? They're not at 0.7%, but they've got a much bigger economy. Now, USAID, one of the biggest ways in which they provide assistance is through food aid, right? Because, and ever more because of the trade wars at the moment, Trump is desperate to provide subsidies to, you know, Idaho farmers, Midwestern farmers. So a huge amount of the grain and oil produced in the US is provided as food aid. And, you know, the World Food Programme, a UN agency that kind of leads on food aid distribution, particularly in humanitarian crises, you know, it's often nicknamed the world food problem because it actually perpetuates the distribution of food because it's so well resourced from the US. So, you know, at the moment in Ethiopia, there's an 8 million people that regularly get food aid. Now they are trying, and there's been a huge amount of research and examination of giving people cash instead of food. Let people buy what they need rather than keep giving them food aid. And although the US has seen all of this, it's still giving out food aid. So when they say, oh, we've given, you know, $2 billion of funds to Ethiopia, $1.5 billion of that could well be food aid, right? The food aid will have been transported by US transporters and logistics and distributors. You have to use US vehicles. You have to get a special waiver if you want to buy non-US vehicles to deliver those foods. Anyone who travels with that program has to travel on US airlines. So they have a very clever way of spending $2 billion, most of which will be feeding back into the States.
But apparently one of the other things that I hadn't appreciated was that very often the food that they're providing, for example, if they're working with US wheat or whatever, apparently it's different to the local African wheat. And therefore people start to develop a taste for this Western wheat, and therefore they find they're importing more of it.
It's not even that. It's just the quality is so much better. I mean, it's just, you know, it's your perfect pure kind of corn kernels. Of course, the local wheat, you know, it's more weedy. It's smaller. It might have a load more mites in it. It's just not good quality. So you are putting, the worst thing about it is you are putting out of business, or you are undermining the development of food systems and agricultural systems in those countries by constantly dumping food on it. Because what a lot of these people do is you get 50 kilos of food aid for your family. You sell half of it to buy the other things you need, to buy, you know, to buy water, you know, to buy firewood, and to buy, you know, something else to eat with it. You might buy some beans or something as well. Or you may need to send kids to school. So the markets are full of imported food aid. So if you're a local producer, not producing this perfect corn, you know, you may as well give up because no one's going to buy it because there's so much free, you know, so much cheap food aid available that everyone's trying to sell bits of. So it's a really complicated system. And I just feel that, you know, I don't want to make the argument that you shouldn't be doing it. I think donors like DFID, and you know, DFID when in the Blair years.
DFID being?
The UK Department for International Development. So they took a role, they took a view, I think, during the Blair years to untie aid. So that means the aid, anything spent has to be just spent on the objective of the program and is spent as efficiently as possible. So if it makes more sense to give out cash and it boosts markets or whatever, of course we'll do it. So, you know, I mean, we don't have the same food export issue or whatever. So the assistance that Ethiopia has given, like from the UK, is much more thoughtful and is much more considered in what it's trying to do in terms of development objectives. Compared to some of the big donors like the US, you know, the US really is trying to advance US interests abroad. And US interests are making sure that those farmers are kept happy and their subsidies towards grain or someone is buying their grain, particularly now with all the trade tariffs on China.
As I understood it, we're sort of moving towards that as well.
So now there is a shift, you know, in to moving towards using aid to do things that will improve trade. Yeah. So, for example, in Kenya, there is an initiative to support rebuilding and, well, it's rebuilding, but improvements to the port, the big Mombasa port, so that it can import and export more and more efficiently, because at the moment the port's capacity is quite limited and that leads to shortages. Looking at breaking, you know, improving one-stop border points so that trade flows can move. And these are all good things for themselves. It's just a shift from a few years ago where their target was things like absolute poverty. So they would be going to the poorest parts of the country and really working on things like, you know, infant and young child feeding programs, looking at the real marginal areas of the country, to a shift to generally helping the economy of Kenya develop. And, you know, there's strong arguments that that's positive as well, because as a country develops and it is stronger and got a bigger economy, it is better able to provide for its own poor. And one of the things I'm doing in East Africa is setting up social protection systems, which is where the government themselves has its own welfare programs for children, for disabled people, for old people, rather than them relying on external food aid assistance.
And in that case, I guess, building their capabilities locally.
Yes, very much. Yeah.
Can I ask you, have some of the emerging economies that have now, I'm showing my age, who've now become superpowers themselves, like China, engaged in aid? And if so, how is that similar or different to, say, the UK or the US?
So there has been aid assistance to China, but that's not the reason it has developed. And this is another interesting theme that you ponder a lot, particularly in Africa, because African governments, they are corrupt, I mean, without a doubt. And they are, there is this obsession with aid being linked to democratic and, you know, improvements and having all the sort of the systems of democracy in place. But then you look at somewhere like China, which without a doubt is, you know, the most miraculous story in terms of people taken out of poverty in such a short timescale that the world has ever seen, done without any democracy whatsoever. So, you know, the argument was, you know, the government really did take a controlled approach to providing a sort of, you know, Marxist solution to development. And, you know, people say, oh, yeah, but they were, you know, could only have one child and they had all these restrictions put on them. And then you go back to this issue, you know, if you go to very poor parts of Africa, they're not really care. They don't care about democracy in that respect, because it's so meaningless for them. They're so removed from, they might be 2,000 miles away from their capital city. They're more interested in the actual individual things that they get. So, you know, if someone is providing, you know, them good water supply, helping them grow better crops, providing them with roads, getting, you know, healthcare for them and their children, they don't care what system is in place to do that.
They just care about the result. And I think
they just care about the result. And I think you have to be at a certain level of development before people start worrying about how often you're having elections and whether you have a kind of a Senate and representatives or whatever. And you see this disconnect a bit in Africa, where you've got urban areas where there's a high level, you know, like places like Nairobi, very cosmopolitan, very, very high levels of education, very aware and active middle class, with, you know, say Northern Turkana, which, you know, really people can't read or write. And yet they're all expected to vote and understand democracy and politics in the same way. What is impressive, and this is something we touched on the other day with it, what's more impressive about parts of Africa is local traditional systems of democracy and participation. And you see how that's what matters to people there.
What do you mean?
So, for example, every village will have an elder. Maybe every group of villages will have like a chief. So they will have these groups and committees that make decisions about things. Yeah. And when there's a problem, you know exactly who to talk to raise it. And they will then go and sit under a tree and talk about it and decide what could or should be done. So in Kenya, the final layer of government systems is the chiefs. So every sort of small area, I think it's called a sublocation, has a chief, and they are actually now paid by the government. So it's actually a salaried position. But the chief is in constant contact with elders and other groups. So you'll have women's groups, you'll have youth groups, you'll have who are constantly, you know, feeling his ear about what's not gone right, what's not gone wrong, whatever. And they will have, there's also this belief that, you know, we've got to sort it out ourselves. So it's not like, oh, they will, you know, they will go back and get us a lot of money. So they will have to come together and sort this out, because they've never had anyone come and sort it out for them.
It's really interesting from the perspective of old fox, young fox. the respect that they have for the elders, and that the elders still have a real role in disseminating wisdom and experience.
Although interesting, it's also interesting to see in these places, because we have this big issue about literacy. So often if one of the things we're doing, which I helped pilot looking at with the Kenyan government, was systems to identify the poorest. So this is a constant problem. So here you have this whole issue, and I can see this when you come back to the UK, the benefit system here. Because these countries are starting benefit systems, in a way they're thinking about things afresh that here we just don't even know how to deal with it. So how do you identify the poorest of the poor? Okay. And in this country, you would go in and there'll be some level of means testing. And because everyone understands the means testing, they game the system. So they know you don't say you work this much, you don't work any other hours or whatever. And actually what you can say, the system here is broke because your benefits are conditional upon you not working. Right? Now, in Africa, they're looking at these systems, but there's absolutely... They're looking at some of them are a bit conditional, but some of them are unconditional. So the idea is we're going to give you a little bit of money to meet your basic needs. And then that will enable you to work as much as you possibly can to further improve yourself, with the understanding that people are absolutely destitute, can't even afford, you know, the 50p bus fare to get to town to look for a job.
Almost like a universal wage or a universal allowance.
Yes. So basically, when I look at transfers in Africa, they are very much these kind of more universal income type thing, you know, so people are given them, and you see the benefits that that makes to people who've been on them for 3 or 4 years.
How is that different to looking at the, say, the system in the UK?
Whereas the problem with the UK is that your system is dependent upon you not earning much money.
Yeah.
So what you find with poor people is the consistency of a small income is usually better than this inconsistent big incomes.
Interesting.
And with the shift to a gig type economy or even zero hours contracts or whatever, getting a job is not that secure. Yeah. So am I better off having £100 a week that is secure or £150 a week that's not secure? Like next year that job might be there, or they may just cut my hours and I don't know I'm going to get £150 every week. Some weeks I might just get 90, whatever. So obviously just being a sensible person, you go, I'll stick with the secure £100 a week. But that will mean I can't get any other job. I can't expand my experience or, you know, work experience or try other things which would make me even more employable. I am better off staying on income support or some other sort of support.
Which is basically excluding me from the economy, right?
Yeah. And that's why you've got, you know, people talk about they have so many people on disability benefits. It's because it's better off to stay having a bad back for as long as possible and have this regular income than risk the turmoil of the job market at the moment. Yeah. And so whereas what you're seeing in Africa is you're seeing people having a guarantee. There is big debates about it. You know, how long should people be on an income? What's the exit strategy? How do we enable people to graduate out of, this is the terminology, to graduate out of poverty? How do we know when they have graduated out of poverty? How do we know when they have sustainably graduated out of poverty? Because there is a concern that obviously as they expand and extend benefits, they'll end up giving them to millions, which is a huge expense on their treasuries.
One of the things I was conscious of, I went to visit some of these millennial villages in Africa, and these are villages where people were applying the latest thinking around development in one mm-hmm. place. To use it as a test case, see whether it worked, what didn't work. And it was fascinating to view this, because I went there not knowing very much about this sort of thing. And my impression was that we were sort of imposing a sort of Western local authority type structure onto a completely different culture. Mm. And we were sort of moving them totally towards our way of thinking. And it just seemed to me that was so arrogant. Mm. And inappropriate. And I think when we last spoke, Catherine, you were talking to me about some Somalis and the way in which their culture operates. And it's got these checks and balances and it's very sophisticated. And to sort of ride roughshod in there with a completely different mindset and impose that as a basis for providing them with aid or whatever, seems to me to be barking.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I suppose that the idea of the Millennium Villages is, yes, we will set up a perfect system and we'll provide all the things you need. You know, we'll have water, we'll have education, we'll have healthcare, and we'll, you know, we'll be doing livelihood and job opportunities. The trouble with that sort of thinking is, one, yes, you are trying to be too restrictive about how everything's got to work and how it's all got to fit together. And the other thing is, it's not possible to do that at scale. You cannot replicate that village across the 550,000 villages in that country.
Yeah. Well, in fairness, they were struggling to perpetuate it in the villages they had. Yeah. Yes. I mean, I got there, and there was a debate about how they were going to fund the medical clinic the following year because the grant ran out.
Mm. Absolutely. And so I think this is, and I think what's interesting about when you go to Africa now is there's so much innovation going on. There's people thinking about things so differently because they have to. So, for example, you know, one thing I used to think about was when we would be looking at cold chains. So how do you get vaccines and medicines to really remote parts of the country where they don't have a reliable refrigeration systems, etc., and things break down? And people were thinking, well, look, Coca-Cola gets a cold Coke to pretty much everywhere in this country. It's like, okay, let's think about how can we work with them to get that happening. Now, I was thinking, if you had that conversation in the UK, not that we have a cold chain problem, but say anything similar, and you said, oh, let's ask Coca-Cola, going, oh my God, no, we're not going to get in bed with that, you know, monolithic capitalist giant who's exploiting whatever. Everything is so ideological in the UK. I find that some conversations can't even be had.
Do you think that's within the sort of the NGO sector as opposed to the wider society?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, maybe in the private sector, that's why the private sector maybe innovates better. But if you were trying to, within government, if you were trying to think of solutions,
yes,
you probably couldn't even think about it. It's just so politically beyond the pale that we can't even think about it. Whereas the good thing about Africa is, although they do have nascent political parties, none of them have a solitary ideology. They're just basically a load of, you know, bigwigs all trying to make their case. They're all offering the same things. Yes, we'll give you more schools. Yes, we'll make you all richer. Yes, we're going to build more roads. Yes, they're all saying the same thing. So actually, as a civil servant within Africa, you just got to find a good way of doing anything. And if you deliver something, the politicians love you. Yeah. So they don't care what you know, solutions come. So again, you're actually allowed to think, if you're able to kind of get the conversations going, you can think about different solutions. And one of the other things you see is the private sector or innovators have got there before government. So when it comes to, for example, electricity, so there's a lot of development of off-grid electricity. And these are being done by private companies, but all you know, social enterprises. And you're really seeing...
When you say off-grid, you basically mean generating your own electricity.
Yes. So, for example, it's really expensive to bring power lines out to all these tiny villages that only use a tiny amount of electricity. So it's almost not worth the investment that they have. And their investment, even in the urban areas, is so that their need for electricity is growing beyond their capability to cope with it. So they're really overwhelmed if you look at the national power companies. So there's a lot of people looking at, you know, so you'd have mini solar, you might just have a solar panel on your roof. So there's a group called MCOPER. They sell you a solar panel, or they actually give you a solar panel, and it's almost like a hire purchase. So you might have to put down maybe a tenth of the cost. And then you pay an amount every week or every month in order to get electricity. And if you stop those payments, they have an electronic chip in it, so the solar panel stops working. So once you restart your payments, you get back your electricity. Yeah. And this is all done through mobile phones. Yeah. And people are paying for it through mobile phones. They make their payments through mobile phones because these are very remote places. And the mobile phone is connected, you know, is linked to that satellite. So if you haven't paid, they will stop your solar panel. That's what I mean. So all these kind of really interesting things. There's something about pedal pumps. Someone was saying that they do the same thing. So again, irrigation systems, very expensive for poor farmers to put in. A company, they'll put in drip feed irrigation with the understanding that the drip feed irrigation system is the deposit that you have, because if you don't pay for it over time, they will come and take it away. But they also have it's operated through a pump. The pump is again linked to, you know, digitally linked, so the GPS. So basically, if you stop making the payments for your irrigation system, it will stop it will stop watering your plants. So it's kind of called grow and pay or something system. So there's all these really clever ideas, which is win-win for everybody, because it means people who don't have who will never have the capital to make the investments they need to give themselves basic services can get them in another way.
That's really interesting, that stuff. And and I think that's effectively moving to a service economy, isn't it? And anything as a service, in that case, pumping as a service or electricity generation as a service. And we are only just starting to see that with the likes of Rolls-Royce starting to think about engines in your plane as a service, for example.
I think there's an awful lot of thinking like that. And for example, so M-Pesa, which is the mobile money service in Kenya, which was started in Kenya and is now it's massive in Kenya. I mean, everyone has a mobile phone and keeps their money on their mobile phone. And that was piloted with the initial idea for that. No one could get funding for Safaricom, the mobile operator that started it, couldn't get funding. And it was a DFID based organization that gave them the seed capital to start that. And I mean, these are, you know, I don't know how much what that was, but you can imagine it was something tiny. And there's something like 17 million M-Pesa users in Kenya. And it has, you know, they reckon it's massively improved GDP and improved the distribution of wealth. Because people who are making money in cities can now send it instantaneously to poor members in the rural areas.
So what does it actually mean for those that have not come across it before? Does it basically
M-Pesa.
Yeah, what does it basically mean you've got an app on your phone and you can put money in it and you can send it to someone else who has the app?
Absolutely. It's like it's not even an app, because you can use it on the old fashioned brick Nokias. Yeah. You just have this M-Pesa use. So you go to an M-Pesa shop and you give them, 2,000 shillings and they put that on your phone. So you've got a balance on your phone. And if I want to send you money, I get your number and I send you, 1,000 shillings, whatever. And the other thing is payment. I mean, I even miss it. When I lived in Kenya, I used to pay all my electricity bills through M-Pesa. If you had a taxi driver, you didn't have the right change, you'd just pay him through M-Pesa. If you had someone like I would, you have work money or house, they have nothing. So they go, I need to go and buy this widget and this tube and that, whatever, to fix your broken, toilet or something. And so they'd say, how much do you need? And they say, I don't know how much it is. So he'd go to the market, he said, yeah, I found it. It's going to cost this much. Can you M-Pesa me the money?
See, this is what I find fascinating, is the fact that these countries, a lot of these countries, aren't saddled with the old infrastructure.
Yeah.
And therefore, they can miss out several generations of technology. They can go straight from A to Z. And again, in the West, we don't have a real perception of that. When people say to you that some of the most advanced countries in the world in terms of electronic banking are in sub-Saharan Africa, for example, and South Africa, people would be quite shocked by that. The first country in the world to use drones to deliver medicines is Rwanda. Now, as far as I was concerned, Rwanda had gorillas, and that was about it. The shooting kind as well as the ape kind. But apparently the first country in the world where they distribute medicines, emergency medicines, by drone. Now, and Malawi has set up quite sophisticated infrastructures, and they're encouraging drone companies to come in and experiment with new ways of using drones in the supply chain and so on.
And by contrast, I have a good friend who's currently working with the Flying Doctors in Australia. And do you imagine the infrastructure to run planes around, to fly around medicine? It's a completely different generation of technology.
But it's this idea that says that, Africa has entrepreneurs and that they are really operating very high-tech areas very effectively. It lays the ghost this notion that says we're out there to help them, when actually they're perfectly capable of helping themselves. They just need a little bit of support in strategic ways, sometimes in terms of cash, sometimes in terms of access to markets. So it's a very different, the reality is very different to the way in which it's presented, I think.
And it's moved very quickly, hasn't it? I was listening to a chap talking about this today, and he said that 30 years ago there were less landlines in Africa than in Manhattan, the island of Manhattan in New York. 20 years on, mobile phones, so the leapfrog past landlines to mobile phones have almost 100% penetration. Is that what you were seeing, Catherine?
Totally. I mean, most Kenyans will not have seen a landline. I mean, they won't know what you're talking about. It's just never been part of their life, you know. And one of the things I'm doing some research at the moment with these youth in Mathare, which is a big slum in Nairobi, where we're providing them with cash. It's one of these cash transfers, but also a smartphone. And people are very interested, you know, there's the whole banking system is how do we reach the youth? Because the demographics of Africa are kind of almost scary. I mean, the average population of Kenya is something like 17 and a half. Yeah. So half the population is under 17. And this is very, very normal in most of Africa. And the other issue that's happening in Africa is urbanization.
Did you say 17 and a half as in years old?
Yes. Yes.
Wow, that's the opposite of the developed world.
Yes,
well,
exactly.
If you take Africa as a whole, I think 75% are under the age of 30.
Yes, that's totally. And so it's kind of scary because they're also becoming the best educated than they've ever been. There has been a huge expansion in primary school education, and certainly in Kenya there's a massive expansion even in secondary. So you are getting now these much more literate, educated, techno-savvy youth coming into urban areas. That's the other big shift in Africa. So they reckon over half the population will be in cities by 2030. So you have got this enormous urban population of youth. And one of the people thinking is, well, what are we going to do with them all? So this research project we're looking at in Mathare, we're giving them youth between 18 and 35, which is quite a lax age limit. But anyway, to youth... cash and a mobile phone, a smartphone. And it's very interesting because none of them are feeling with the money they should open a bank account. Yeah. So most of them are using this mobile money because it's secure and it's safe and they don't need to go to a physical bank. A physical bank is a pain to get to. It's not open very often. It's unnecessary when I can keep it on my phone.
That's really interesting because I've been quite interested in financial inclusion and microfinance and the idea that people are outside the formal economy and can't get into the banking environment. And perhaps if we could help them open a bank account, everything would be fine. But that's already completely out of date by what you've just described.
Yeah, so things are moving quicker than are even our thought about, oh, what's a good thing to have? It's a good thing to be formally informal, you know, inclusion. And so we're seeing a lot of interesting things. I mean, it's too much to go into about that, but we're seeing very interesting things about the value of mobile phones and how these youth use them to make money. So, for example, before they used to buy, I don't know, you'd see someone on the side of the road selling secondhand clothes and old shoes or something like that. Now what they do is they go to the big markets. And they network with everyone. They're all on Instagram and Facebook and WhatsApp. And they're saying, you know, what are you looking for? What are you looking for, Oliver? You're looking for Nike trainers. You're looking for what, a size 10? They will go to the big, and they will go around and take photos of all the Nike trainers that they find in size 10. WhatsApp them to you and say, which one do you want, Oliver? I can get you one for 2,000 shillings. Just tell me. And that's how they're selling clothes rather than having a stall on the street corner.
Wow. Yeah?
And so there's a lot of interesting things to the way people think. And so when I come back to the UK and I think all of the problems, you know, the issues that are here, what are we doing about it? What are we doing about our marginal areas and our marginalized youth? You know, and when I go back and you look at places like the Sunderlands or the Burnleys or the Blackpools or the places that are really, I see huge parallels with these issues about what are you doing with the left behind places in northern Kenya, in southern Ethiopia, or in Karamoja in Uganda.
It almost sounds like the youth that you've described in Nairobi might be more empowered than perhaps some of the youth that we've experienced in the UK, based on the system.
Yeah, I mean, this is where the anthropology of it, and I'm working with this quite interesting anthropologist on the Kenya stuff, is understanding mindsets. And is it, because what we're seeing with the cash and what we're going to track with this cash, they get it for 2 years, some of them get it for 2 years, some of them get a lump sum, some of them get 2 years payment, is whether the benefits are sustained. And trying to understand who are the mindsets of actual entrepreneurs. And we're the ones that are necessity entrepreneurs, right? You have to do something to make a living in Africa, yeah? And, you know, maybe invention, whatever they say, with necessity. And maybe that's a bit that's missing in the UK. There's not the idea that you can strive to something. And I wonder that's, you know, is that the difference between a London environment and an environment in being in a small town, which is post-industrial, where you don't feel there's any opportunities? And can you change that around? And how would you do that? And how would you create this self-help actual mentality, which is obviously very strong in Africa because they never expect anyone else to help you to sort things out. So, you know, there's a story I always tell is in Ireland, I've got family in Ireland, and I was driving along a road in the west of Ireland with my niece, she was like 8 at the time. And the road was really bad. And well, it wasn't bad. It had a few potholes. And she was going, oh, this road is really bad. And I was saying, oh, you should see the roads in Africa. They're much worse than this. And she goes, don't people complain to the council? And I always thought that was a really interesting thing that she said, because it would never cross their minds to complain to the council. But in our country, even an 8-year-old child thinks we must complain to the council. So this whole issue about who's accountable for change and who is responsible for change. And I do wonder who's got it right, in that obviously I do feel that governments have a duty to their people, for sure. And that's why you elect them. But where does the accountability of yourself to do things, where does that stop?
But equally, in Africa, you do have a very different sort of philosophy around community and family. Mm. And I mean, I came across
and this, support, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
This notion of Ubuntu, forgive my Swahili, I haven't used it for a while, but it seems to be a sort of underlying philosophy about you are part of a group and you get your sense of self by being part of this group. I think I've got a description of it here somewhere, where there exists a common bond between us, and it is thought that through this bond, through our interaction, our fellow human beings, that we discover our own human qualities. And it seems to be this notion that says we're part of a community. We have a responsibility to the community. And if one of us is successful, it's our responsibility to share that benefit with everybody. And this sense of community and connectedness we've lost. I think it's a natural human condition. And it used to be very evident in our society. Mm. I mean, if you used to go to mining communities where there were very close-knit communities, very often poorer communities, there was that sense of collective responsibility and obligations to a degree.
You get that in the colonies because people will say, we're in this together.
But it means something there. I mean, there was a great... Sorry.
Yeah. Well, no, I agree. I feel it's different because you can look at it both ways in Africa. You know, also people, you know, Africans will tell you the African tax is you can never make anything of yourself in Africa, because the minute you make any money, you've got everyone looking off you. You know, like, you know, I had someone, she worked for me. She's just married a guy who's got 10 brothers and sisters. Like, 7 of them are living on almost destitution level in Western Kenya, like subsistence farmers, where it's not. He's the only one with a job in his entire family. And they can never save for a house or a car or anything, because he's sending, you know, he's responsible for about 15 children's secondary school fees. And it's expected that that's what he'll pay, but he's actually never going to get anywhere. So
is it expected that any of those other people would make the transition to the type of work that he's doing?
Well, so this was the problem previously in a country like, you know, Kenya. If you made it through secondary school, you were a big fish in a small sea. You could walk into any civil servant's job, the NGO would take you, you know, anyone looking for someone who can basically read and write. Now you're getting to the level where you've got, certainly in Nairobi, you're going to have probably 70% of people finishing secondary school. You've got more graduates than ever before. And you've got, I think, you know, the statistics, they reckon there's about 70,000 formal sector jobs created each year in Kenya. Yeah. As I explained, there is 1 million children turn 18 every year in Kenya. So do the maths. Yeah? There is nothing like the jobs being created in the formal sector that are needed for those people. So this group of youth that we've got in the slums, 3% of them have a formal job. The rest of them are working as casual labourers or having to work for themselves. And all of them, if given the opportunity, want to work for themselves because they see that as the only way of making any money. No one even expects to get a formal job. And so maybe that's what, you know, does make them think quite creatively about, you know, about what they're going to do. But the interesting thing about groups, one of the other things we're looking at a lot, and I've looked at a lot, is groups. And a lot of it aid goes through groups. So you have, say, women's groups, you have savings and credit groups, you might have pharma groups. So looked a lot at these group structures, and even this project in Nairobi, we've identified youth through groups. And we're studying it because what we find is some of the groups are incredibly strong. And the money, the cash transfer has made them stronger. Some of the groups have fallen apart since they've been given cash. So you, and what we're trying to look at, and we haven't quite got to it, is what are the reasons for strong, you know, groups survive and groups fail. And I did some work with an economist a few years ago in Ethiopia. They have this whole self-help group. There was this self-help group program established by, I think it was Tear Fund, who are a kind of Christian NGO that don't have much money, and they didn't have much money to do this. So they actually worked through churches to just train some community facilitators to support often really poor women to get into groups and help themselves. And they didn't give them anything apart from 6 months of regular trainings, and regular meetings to help set themselves up. And these groups, they started with 20 in one town called Nazareth, and they've now got something like 300,000 of these groups in Ethiopia. And they've been amazingly successful. And having looked at them, one of the reasons is because they spend their time not about savings and credit. A lot of these groups are put together and, hey, okay, we're all going to give 50p a week. And then, you know, as soon as we've got £50, someone's going to borrow 10 and whatever. They build the social capital of the group so much more, so that these people are like socially and sort of emotionally invested in each other, so that they actually rely on each other to support themselves through life generally.
So they are a community.
Yes. Yeah. And I think a lot of programs that try and get to the groups, you see so many groups and committees and things formed for a project. Hey, we've come up here, we've got £5,000 to spend on wells. If you get a water committee together, you can have it. Yeah. And after that 5,000 is spent, the water committee falls apart and stuff. So you see that. So there's quite a subtlety to supporting groups. But one of the interesting things I felt when I saw these self-help groups, because they are quite amazing, they're quite inspirational to talk to these, mostly women, there's now ones that have men and women and men's ones, etc., is could we start this up in some of these low-income marginal estates in the UK? You know, you get groups of women together who are in a very similar situation, and you spend 6 months establishing them to support each other. Because so many of the ills you see in society is people have no one to turn to, you know, just for that, you know, what do I do in this situation? I just lost my temper with my kid and I think I've really, like, you know, been over the top, or I've got this debt and I don't quite know how to pay it. Just having a network of people who can support you through things. And then the idea is, the philosophy of the groups is very much, how are you going to solve that? So you throw every question that they have back to themselves and help them to develop solutions to their own problems. And that in itself has this cumulative ability to help people strengthen their own sense of confidence, well-being, and you know, optimism about what they can do and what they can change.
Do you know, that sounds a little bit like young parenting groups.
Well, I think there are lots of these sort of things. I mean, if you're in London, where you've got a lot of knife crime, you've got mothers who've got together because they think that only by working together they can keep their kids safe and away from the gangs and the knife crime. So again, it comes back to this. It's this behavioural, this behavioural stuff around, you know, potentially the role of government or local authorities is to create the circumstances that allows people to be more empowered. Yes. And I think that brings it back to this notion that says, you know, the further you devolve responsibility and power down the chain, so it's, you know, the better. Mm. So communities are more empowered and allowed to take responsibility for their own circumstances. And when you and I were talking last, Catherine, we you know, the concept of
you know, flat pack democracy came up. You know, the idea of getting rid of politics at a local level, allowing local communities to get more organized, ensuring that they've got sufficient resources to allow them to remove the blocks that prevent communities gathering and sort of solving their own problems, as opposed to the expectation that the local authority is going to solve the problem for you. So if they were there taking away the obstacles and creating the environment that allows people to be empowered, I think there's a really powerful thought in there. Is there any evidence that there's transfer of learning from somewhere like Kenya or wherever to the more deprived parts of Britain, or is this still all trapped down in the subcontinent?
I don't know, because I mean, I'm not actually working now in development in the UK, much as I'd be kind of interested to, because I think there is a lot of joint problems, joint ways, you know, that we could look at things in the way that, you know, having looked at what's been tried there, because, you know, in those countries, everyone is thinking, how can we develop this place from scratch? You know, whether the Kenyan government, even when you're in private sector, you know, we need people to be richer. We know they're buying our stuff. We need people to use this. Everyone is thinking about this. So whereas I find here, people don't think, there's not so many people thinking about it in the same way. They're too busy just with the doing.
And isolated as well, right?
Yeah. And one of the things with this issue of like self-help groups and participatory groups, well, the other big issue that I'm always obsessing with is how do you scale a good idea? You know, because there's always good initiatives if you look hard enough for them. Because people are always looking for, oh, can we have an example of best practice or a case study of something great? And you can go and you can find that. And the question is, everyone says, why isn't that happening everywhere? Yeah. So when you've got a group of 20 mothers in Hackney who've come together to support their kids, why isn't that happening everywhere? What would it take for that to happen everywhere? And what would take that? And so with this self-help groups in Ethiopia, how they scale, they went from like 20 groups to like we've got 300,000 of them now, is what people said, because the success of this group is the bonds in the group members. So what they would always get is after a year or so, people would come along and go, oh, can I join your group? It looks great. It sounds fantastic. I know, I've heard about it from her. She's my friend and my sister. I want to join. And they go, no, sorry, you can't, because what makes this group work is the relationship we all have. But you go and find 10 friends. We will come. One of us will come and work with you for 6 months to set us up. Yeah. And when you had an area that had 10 or 15 of these groups, they would create a subgroup that was just a training group or a sort of promotion and mentoring group that had the role of helping groups that wanted to form to start. Yeah. And then they created a federation that aligned itself to the co-ops department in the government to enable them to get some registration and da da da. So they had thought through, how do we go from being one group that works and we're doing very well, thank you very much, to a network of like-minded groups that just basically people that want to help themselves.
I wonder if part of this is because one group, the very broad group that we're talking about in places in Africa, start off with very little in their own minds. But perhaps the other group in places like the UK and New Zealand and Australia and America start off feeling like they deserve and have some entitlement, and perhaps that they're losing it as life goes on. So one's growing and the other feels like it's dying.
Yes.
But equally, I suspect that it's because of our, you know, we've got regulations and we've got this and we've got that, that you're allowed to do things, you're not allowed to do things. I suspect in Africa, there are far few constraints on doing something. You just get up and do it. Mm. I mean, you don't have problems of health and safety regulations in Africa. You just, you know, you do crazy things, and if it works, great. Nobody's there to interfere. Mm. So there is that sort of thing. But equally, I think it's about intention. If it was recognised as being an important contribution, then I think someone in central government, if they were responsible for these sort of community initiatives, would set up a structure and provide the finance to allow that to happen and filter the money down to local authorities. It's because there's a lack of intention, maybe imagination, and also
maybe understanding the value of doing it.
Or even appreciating the value of it. Because my understanding is that an awful lot of people in the Home Office and in government are so detached from what's going on in the real world that it doesn't occur to them. You know, they're just not And actually, they don't see that as their role. They see their role as making sure their minister looks good.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, no, I mean, I think the other problem, of course, is that how do you keep the momentum with the community groups and with the community who've identified the idea? Once you try to institutionalise something, you know, that's in a way, once you try and institutionalise something like social care, it loses a lot of the fact that what it was there to sort of be developed. So I struggle with this idea of how, you know, something's good, okay, central government should now take responsibility for it, because it's no, the idea is communities have decided to take responsibility for something. All you have to do is facilitate that.
If the government is facilitating that, I think that's the key. And I think, but equally, I do think there needs to be some sort of financial incentive somewhere within it. And I remember being told about a situation in Africa where I think it was the Gates Foundation were providing mosquito nets. And because mosquito nets were, you know, they're going to solve child mortality and so on and so forth. Mm. And they had warehouses full of these mosquito nets and no mechanism to take them from the warehouse out into the rural areas. And they were just sitting there for years. And then someone came up with the idea of, you have these district nurses with bicycles. And I think they gave them something like a shilling or something, or, you know, 10 pence for every mosquito net that they delivered. Mm-hmm. And within months, these things were, you know, the warehouses were empty and these things were out there doing good. So I do think that having some sort of mechanism in there that incentivizes people at a financial level, if that's the model that we're all going to live within, is a useful way of thinking, as opposed to this idea of giving everybody something free.
But I think also underneath that, there's also somebody there thinking there's a better way of doing this.
Which I think then becomes... that's the role of government, it seems to me, or larger institutions, that they've got the people to spend the time thinking about that. And then you need mechanisms to engage people and enroll people and to sort of keep them motivated.
But maybe that's actually a sign of sort of an older style of thinking, being that things should be centralized. Because while you're both talking, I'm thinking, all through my life, people have been arguing about whether something should be publicly or privately run. Maybe the actual question is whether it should be centrally or decentrally run.
But it's not about the running of it necessarily, as the thinking.
But that's what I'm talking about, because the I'm just using run as a word for getting things done. Because what Catherine's talking about is very decentralized groups getting things done and thinking from the ground up. How do we take this success and duplicate it to other areas, right? Whereas what you're talking about is, how do we take the centralized machine, which is actually getting larger in the UK government, and all of the staff that work within it, and make them more useful to the people on the ground?
I think it's both to a degree.
I don't know if governments are the best for thinking up these ideas, because like you say, most of them never leave their offices.
I think there need to be different people there, clearly. But I'm just thinking more in terms of the resource. And again, it comes back to this idea that says, one of my criticisms of the existing structure for NGOs, development NGOs, is actually the problems that people are trying to deal with are industrial-sized problems. Mm. And therefore, you have to, in the end, if you really want to have impact on it, you have to have industrialized solutions. Mm. And therefore, you need to be able to operate at scale. So having some well-motivated individuals in a particular area doing something in their local area is great. But I think in order to scale up, there are only a certain number of organisations that are capable of doing that sort of heavy lifting, and they tend to be big business and government. So the fact that they're not, and there's a role for big business in this, or for businesses in this, providing the incentives are appropriate, I think there are dangers with that, and that's another, it's a separate conversation. But this hand-knitted thing is great, and it makes people feel good. But if you really want to impact on the problem, I think you need other ways of thinking about it.
I don't know. I look at it quite differently, because I think you've got to think, what is the government's role to ensure this happens everywhere? So, for example, if you're saying, if we're saying we want self-help groups, right, rather than saying, OK, we're going to have some sort of central group, what these groups need is, they might need something as simple as a place to meet. like it's a big issue. Even, you know, like here in London, there's very few community halls anymore. Even churches are closing down and boarding up, and places, public spaces for people to just meet and come together in an urban environment are really difficult sometimes.
But that's, you see, for me, that's about diagnosis. It's about identifying what are the obstacles to this happening. And once you've identified what the obstacles are, that's the role of some other body to say, okay, if we remove those obstacles or minimize them as far as possible, do we then empower local communities to then operate in a much more effective way?
Yes, and there can be multiple service suppliers for something. So, for example, if you want to be, you know, you want to have community-based groups that support young mothers, you know, young mothers on low incomes or something, or young mothers with, you know, people, you know, their children are at danger of knife crime, for example. Rather than saying every local authority is going to have a knife crime community support unit, you would say we want you to develop a solution for that. It might be that your local authority has a knife crime community support unit. It might be that you develop a network of, you know, Mums Against Crime community level there. I think the idea is to be open to what's the end result? If the end result is what you want, we don't care how you get there so much.
I think that one of the Chinese presidents said something to the effect of, it doesn't matter what colour your mousetrap is, providing it catches the mouse. And,
yes.
So not ideologically bound.
And that's this thing about, for example, when, you know, people say, oh, let's privatise, you know, the railways. The issue is, what we want is high quality, affordable railways, you know, which will involve having well motivated and well paid staff. How can we deliver that? Who delivers it is kind of irrelevant. What people are feeling at the moment, the private sector isn't quite getting there. And I don't think anyone would say, well, the government, you know, the pure state approach either. But we have moved to a third way, I think, about thinking about this, how you can get incentives right that include both a private sector element, but that it sort of with other outputs being the measures of success.
I think there used to be a thing called community bonds. I don't know if it still exists now, where if there was a major social problem and you intervened and made a difference to it and saved some money as a consequence, something like, for the sake of argument, a Young Offenders Institute, I think it cost something like £46,000 a year to have a young person in a Young Offenders Institute. If he doesn't reoffend, or if he doesn't go there, then you're saving £46,000 a year. If he doesn't reoffend, you're saving, you know, that every year. And if therefore, maybe you should be taking a percentage of that saving, which is what they were doing. But I think I'm not completely clear.
They are thinking about that. It's community impact bonds. There's a lot of thinking about that. And that's one of the things that I've had discussions with people who are looking at doing it in the UK and overseas, and trying to establish what would be the outcomes for which you get paid. So, for example, it would be something like you were saying about the mosquito net. So you would say to... So DFID would say to maybe any contractor, we want to reduce malarial rates in this area from X percent to 1% or something. And if you achieve that, we will give you £1 million a year. And the idea is that will save them from spending, trying to do it themselves, they know will cost £2 million a year. Yeah. Because they would have to go through all the contracting and processes, and they'd have to subcontract and manage all these NGOs to do it and whatever. But they make it, the private sector will organise a way of doing this far more efficient, because they kind of are getting a yield of £1 million a year if they deliver that outcome. That's what DFID are interested in, is that reduction in malaria at this price. And that enables people to think all different ways about doing something.
There has
been a bit of thinking about that.
Well, I think when they implemented it, I think they did it with prisons, and they did it on something about reoffending.
Yes, it's in Peterborough. Yes, it's
But one of the difficulties with it was that, as I understand it, the people delivering the service did very well, and according to the department responsible for them, were making too much money. So change the rules or change the criteria, which seems to me to be a ridiculous thing to do. But also it's a little bit like with NGOs with development work, where increasingly private sector consultancies are moving in and taking over what used to be done by NGOs.
What do you mean?
Well, NGOs, international development agencies, are not for profit.
McKinsey is for profit. And what's happening is that whereas in the past, the NGO would be responsible for delivering a program in Kenya for to deliver X, Y, and Z, what's happened now is that some of these private sector organizations can bid for that work, and then they'll effectively subcontract it to the international development agencies to do it, but clearly they're making their money out of it. And the difficulty with that is that people operating in NGOs tend to be a vocation. Well, there's a large number of people in there who are operating from a vocation as opposed to a profit motive. Whereas, you know, if you're working in a major consultancy, you know, you've got shareholders you've got to satisfy. You need to meet your, you know, they charge huge amounts of money. And I think there's a dissonance that's set up in there. So I like this notion of a third way where you have organizations that are really genuinely well motivated and feel that they've got some sort of social responsibility, but are able to make enough money to survive, or not just survive, but where the people within them don't have to work for very little money. They can work at proper rates, so they can have a proper quality of life in the same way they would if they were working for a big consultancy, but they've got the right sort of value system.
I agree with you, and I really like what I'm hearing from Catherine in terms of the approach to enabling people by giving them the foundation they need to innovate and create their own life. And I think that that's quite an important distinction for me also in this conversation, that throwing corn over the fence is not as helpful as cash in a mobile phone, for example. Yeah. And I wonder if we can apply a lot more of that to what's happening around us from the bottom up, as well as what you're talking about. When we look at the UK or New Zealand and places like Australia, or places that have really big growing poverty problems like the US, that they also need people to be empowered rather than disempowered, brought together rather than isolated.
Yeah, no, I think you're summing it up quite nicely there.
Oh, well done, Ollie. the one thing that does concern me a bit is this idea, you know, I'm heavily into this, the idea of the law of unintended consequences. And when you look at Africa and you look at the way in which they're developing and they're adopting many of our sort of ways of thinking, you know, what potentially can they be losing as a consequence of that? So you've got one of the major advantages that Africa's got is got its agricultural sector. It's got huge potential for agriculture. But all the young people are moving off the land into the cities, creating slums and things because they can't get work. It doesn't have the status it once had. How do you rebalance that? Because you can't expect, I mean, it's quite understandable if you're a young person, you want to go to the city, make money, have your car, have your house, have your this, have your that. But driving them off the land is not an appropriate thing to do. And similarly, breaking down some of these strong community linkages and support systems as everybody pursues their own life is also not hugely helpful. We're suffering hugely from that, it seems to me.
I've seen that with the Indigenous people of New Zealand, Australia and Canada.
Yes.
So why do we want to replicate that? How do we protect what's good in these cultures and potentially transfer more of that to us than just sort of watch whilst it's diluted and potentially destroyed?
That is a very interesting question, but it might be after something we have to start talking about another time. Because
indeed. But I have to say, I do like this idea of Ubuntu, which I mentioned earlier. Apparently, people are developing it as a management model to take into larger organisations and to create much more of a sense of community in organisations.
What's it called? Ubuntu?
It's called Ubuntu. It's spelled U-B-U-N-T-U.
As in the Linux package that's used by a lot of people in tech, Ubuntu.
Yeah.
Okay.
It comes out of Swahili.
Yes.
I am what I am because of who we all are, which is a really interesting sort of humanistic 21st century sort of business model, it seems to me. We are all part of the same system, and it has to work for all of us to be sustainable and effective. And on that note, yes. Ollie.
How can people reach you or reach some of the work that you've talked about, Catherine?
What's your website, Catherine?
I don't have a website.
You don't have a website. Okay, well, in which
I'm
case...
I'm not very technologically okay. developed, despite all the tech happening in Africa.
Exactly. You need to go to Africa. Get your yeah, act together.
Exactly.
What I suggest then, if anybody is interested in contacting Catherine, get through to yes. us and we'll obviously...
Yes. And you can pass on my email. I'm afraid, yeah, I'm still on that.
No, that's fine. But look, thanks ever so much. And I'm sure there'll be other opportunities to explore some of these other areas. But that's been great.
Yeah, no, great. Marvellous. I do wish we had more time. Thank Indeed. You very much. Take care.
Okay. Night. Thanks a lot. Bye.
And welcome to the reflection section. We thought this particular conversation deserved it because it opened up so many doors of inquiry. What do you think of that, Jeremy?
Well, I thought it was a great conversation. And it sort of raises all sorts of issues for me. One is I really like this idea of transferring experiences and knowledge from somewhere like Africa, where we potentially could benefit from it, where there's a completely different way of thinking about things, particularly social issues, that we could benefit from. And that's just Africa. I mean, and we've got a whole globe to choose from, but we seem to be very insular in how we don't seem very good at adapting and adopting ideas from elsewhere.
I mean, you look at the closed mentality to the ideas of the European zone at the moment, right?
Indeed, yeah. And I suppose also the opportunity just to sort of try and sort of rebalance people's perceptions about the role of international development and also some of the hidden stories around the fact that, you know, a lot of this debt that these countries have gathered was unlawful debt. And it was, you know, we are complicit in that as a country. We are one of the biggest tax havens in the world. You know?
And also one of the major arms manufacturers.
Yeah. And we're not conscious of that. Very often, a lot of the problems that are caused, we're sort of party to. And
I'd like to get someone on to talk about that. And particularly the, just coming back to what you were saying about the illegal nature of some of these, or maybe immoral nature of some of these loans that have created a culture of debt and paying back.
And the scale of it, scale of the debt that they're paying back.
It's enormous, right? Because we're talking dams and highways and information networks and large things, right? I'd love to get somebody in to talk to us about how that could be transitioning to more of a microfinance or empowerment model. First of all, what we can do about that and these problems, and perhaps eventually we need to just say that was an illegal loan. You've paid back a lot of money over time. An end has to come to this to allow you to grow. And secondly, other ways that finance can be used to empower.
But it's about us as a country making a decision whether we want to be involved in that sort of business or not.
Exactly.
Because essentially it's our banks, it's our government, it's our institutions who are facilitating this, and they call it international trade or something. But actually most of us, you know, if you sit down and think about it, well, actually it's not. And
I'd like to get someone in from Dublin as well, because they've, in terms of transfer pricing and the movement of profit between countries and the tax incentives that certain companies, particularly in tech, get to work and be placed in certain places. Dublin and has just been incredibly astute in that. And this amazing economy has grown there. And the head offices for so many of the large tech giants for Europe and sometimes even EMEA are based now in Dublin and no longer in London because of tax reasons. So I think it'd be interesting to talk to someone about what it's been like to be in Dublin for that and what's happening and what can we do about that?
Hmm. I think, yeah, and I think what we do about it is people start having to be a bit more vocal about it, and they have to vote with their wallet, and they have to be, you know, more active about it if that's what we... And clearly we need to have other ways in which we as a country can generate our income.
Yeah.
And to a degree, the whole Brexit situation is actually an opportunity for us to rebalance our economy, it seems to me, and maybe it gives us not a chance to talk about these things and make more sort of value-based decisions about what we want to do. But the other thing...
On that point, you know, I've read that England's two major exports from the UK are cereals, as in corn, like we were talking about the US example, and secondly are finance and information technology. So when you talk about how we want to make our money, do we want to be a laundromat for money that comes from certain places, or a place where certain types of commerce are conducted, or do we want to evolve that to more of an innovation-driven model?
Ollie and I were talking about a film a little earlier about this sort of thing, and it was actually called Laundromat. I couldn't remember the name, but check it out, Laundromat with Meryl Streep and Antonio Banderas. Very, very good film. But the other big thing that I remember reading something a long time ago about how with the developing economies being more in the East and so on and so forth, and how the economic power was starting to drive everything, what was coming with that was the attitude towards work and the work cultures and expectations of people, Chinese companies buying large stakes in British companies and so on. There was a question about whether they would be expecting a change in the work ethic, because in China, if you go out to work in a factory, you work all days, all hours of the day and night, and you're not paid very much for it. It is a very different sort of model. And as Chinese management start taking over British companies, was that going to happen? But equally, there's an alternative pressure, which is they're adopting Western values and Western ways of operating an organization. The question was, which one would actually succeed? Which one would be the more powerful one? And then you've got others, where in India, you've got this focus on the family. And clearly in Africa, you've got this focus on the family, where it's a different set of values and it's a broader sense of quality of life that comes into play.
And a different set of responsibilities. If you think of that chap who's got 10 yes. siblings that he is expected to yes. support.
But I would hope that we get a bit of a balance. And, I'm really interested in creating work environments that are fit for people to work in.
A middle way.
Yeah, just something a bit more sensible. That's not so driven by, the needs of shareholders and the needs of consumption. And
get perhaps it's just a different view of what a shareholder is.
Yes. Well,
perhaps
absolutely.
It's not just a financial shareholder,
absolutely.
But a societal shareholder.
But I love the idea that Africa has a way of thinking about these things that is a very modern, potentially a very modern way of thinking.
Perhaps more modern.
Yeah. And we, again, I personally don't think of Africa traditionally as being where I would get that sort of philosophical sort of juice from. I'd think, okay, China and Japan and all this sort of stuff, but I wouldn't think of Africa. And yet it's got these huge traditions and these very effective community methodologies. I mean, I was working on a project around gangs, youth gangs in London and so on. And it occurred to me that in Africa, there's a very different relationship that they have with elders and children and so on and so forth. I don't think they have the same degree of problem with their adolescents as we do.
Relative to GDP, yeah.
Well, relative to anything. I mean, and we're giving them money and think that we're helping them. But actually, we could go to them and they could give us help in terms of reconnecting ourselves with our children.
That's a good point. And you know, that's something that I've observed as someone that grew up in the Southern Hemisphere and came to London as a child and then again as an adult. When I walk the streets in London, I realize that one of the unintended benefits of colonialism is that the culture of the people that are colonized, invaded, comes with those people seeking a better life back to the heart of the empire. And so France, Spain, Portugal, Holland, and Belgium and England are all full of people that have come from other parts of the world and brought their culture with them while seeking a better life. And I think that that could be the salvation of some of the culture of some of those places. I met a woman from Lisboa, from Lisbon, who said, I don't like all these Brazilian people coming over to Lisboa and they play their music too loud. And afterwards I thought, yeah, but they are probably the people that are starting the businesses. They're probably the people that are cleaning the hotels, fixing the holes in the road, that are actually making the economy function.
But equally, I think it's where I'm coming from, is that the current model, business model that we've got, is not sustainable.
Yes.
It's creating huge problems in our society.
in terms of inequality, in terms of mental health, in terms of our value system. And I think it's coming to an end because people don't want that anymore. So what model are we going to transition to? Who are we using as our model? And it just seems to me that this notion of Mbantu is one. Okay, sure. We'd have to maybe make it more. And I'm not clear that we haven't had it within our society in the past anyway, but it chimes with conversations I'm having with other people around this notion of systemic win or mutual benefit. Mm. Because I'm conscious that very often in these conversations, I think I come across as being a bit liberal and a bit sort of a bit too wishy-washy and...
Perish the thought.
Yeah, and I'm not. I'm actually quite commercial, but I do see this as being... We have a vested self-interest in ensuring...
A mutual interest.
Absolutely. For all elements of the mix to benefit, not just one group to benefit. Otherwise, it is not sustainable.
Yeah, and ultimately it all comes back to the basic human needs, doesn't it? And one of those needs is the need to belong. And that need to belong, like you say, in our current financial and economic model is not being provided for.
I'm going to tell you a story about that I read about this Ubuntu thing. Because I thought it summed it up quite nicely. It was an anthropologist who was in Africa.
Do go on.
Don't worry. And he was doing a study of African habits and customs and so on. And he was surrounded by children most of the time. And he decided to test this idea of Ubuntu. And so he got some sweets and he put them under a tree. And he went to the kids and he said, right, the first child to go to the tree and find the sweets can have all of them. And what the children did is they got together, they lined up and they held hands and they went to the tree together, found the sweets together, sat down under the tree and shared the sweets and enjoyed it. And he went to them and he said to them, you know, why did you do that? You could have had them all to yourself. And the children responded, Ubuntu. How could any one of us be happy if all the others were sad? Ubuntu is a philosophy of African tribes that can be summed up as, I am what I am because of who we all are, because of who we all are. And I just quite like that, this idea of interdependence. It doesn't prevent you being an individual, it doesn't prevent anything, but it's just a recognition that we are all connected.
It's an awareness, isn't it? And also an awareness of responsibility and connectedness. I agree. Folks, thank you for tuning in. You know how to subscribe on Spotify and Apple iTunes. And I'm sure that there will be plenty more interesting discussions to follow. Bye.